All right, kids, it is now my job to teach you the theory of evolution.
Oh, boy.
Now, I, for one, think that evolution is a bunch of bull crap, but I've been told I have to teach it anyway. It was thought up by Charles Darwin, and it goes something like this. In the beginning, we were all fish, okay, swimming around in the water. And then one day, a couple of fish had a retard baby, and the retard baby was different, so it got to live. So retard fish goes on to make more retard babies, and then one day a retard baby fish crawled out of the ocean with its mutant fish hands, and it had butt sex with a squirrel or something and made this, retard frog squirrel. And then that had a retard baby, which was a monkey fish frog. And then this monkey fish frog had butt sex with that monkey, and that monkey had a mutant retard baby that screwed another monkey, and that made you. So there you go. You're the retarded offspring of five monkeys having butt sex with a fish squirrel. Congratulations.
It's time.
Listen to me. Please listen. If you don't, if you won't, if you fail to understand, then the same incredible terror that's menacing me will strike at you!
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into
a new world order.
I don't want any part of it.
You're forgetting something, Miles.
What's that?
You have no choice. Suddenly, while you're asleep, they'll absorb your mind.
As a young man growing up in New York City, I refused to pledge allegiance to the flag. Of course, I was sent to the principal's office, and he asked me, "Why don't you want to pledge allegiance? Everybody does." I said, "Everybody once believed the earth was flat, but that doesn't make it so." I explained that America owed everything it has to other cultures and other nations, and that I would rather pledge allegiance to the earth and everyone on it. Needless to say, it wasn't long before I left school entirely, and I set up a lab in my bedroom. There I began to learn about science and nature. I realized then that the universe is governed by laws, and that the human being, along with society itself, was not exempt from these laws. Then came the crash of 1929, which began what we now call the Great Depression. I found it difficult to understand why millions were out of work, homeless, starving, while all the factories were sitting there. The resources were unchanged. It was then that I realized that the rules of the economic game were inherently invalid. Shortly after came World War II, where various nations took turns systematically destroying each other. I later calculated that all the destruction and wasted resources spent on that war could have easily provided for every human need on the planet. Since that time, I have watched humanity set the stage for its own extinction. I have watched as the precious finite resources are perpetually wasted and destroyed in the name of profit and free markets. I have watched the social values of society be reduced into a base artificiality of materialism and mindless consumption. And I have watched as the monetary powers control the political structure of supposedly free societies. I'm 94 years old now, and I'm afraid my disposition is the same as it was 75 years ago. This shit's got to go.
Up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, it's the August 9th Nagasaki Day edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. Nagasaki, of course, is the Japanese town of civilians bombed by the Harry Truman, the Führer at that time of the U.S., I should say the President as we called him, with 70,000 civilian deaths. I'm not sure if there were also American soldiers killed there as well, because I think some American soldiers are being held as prisoners of war in some of these cities, either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Anyway, coming up on this edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, we're going to conclude the Citizens Police Review Board hearing of the fall of 2002, where that board, before it was decapitated by the city council several months later and replaced by an ineffective behind-closed-doors police auditor, Bob Aronson, who still holds that post and gets paid for it. The CPRB, Citizens Police Review Board in Santa Cruz, actually looked into selective enforcement and recommended a policy to the city council, which they never even put on their agenda, in violation, I believe, of the its rules for commissions and policies sent to city council. I think they're supposed to do that, or they were at that time. Anyway, we're going to hear more about that, the second half of that hearing. We may also be hearing a number of other things that I'm not quite sure how much of this we can squeeze in. There's a back issue of Club Cruise where then-Mayor Chris Crone is interviewed by activist Becky Johnson. We're also going to be looking in on what happened to the nuclear test site, sort of as a recognition that this is Nagasaki Day and the nuclear weapons are, well, the clock is at 2 minutes to midnight, as the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists would put it. And we're also going to do what I had hoped we were going to do on Sunday, listen to the audio of a video by James Duan, a professor on the East Coast, about, well, he heads his talk, Don't Talk to the Police. And there may even be a snippet of actual street interviews. Not much happening around that this time, but, well, what you hear is what you're going to get.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
I also didn't mention that we were going to be looking, or listening rather, to some bits from the City Council special session, which was held on Tuesday, concerning a couple of items, a tax that the city council pulled off the ballot because of a state law that was recently passed, the sugar soda tax. And then the much more heated and interesting, actually I don't know how interesting, but certainly important debate, where the positions are rather strongly staked out about whether to give the anti-rent control forces more time to make up for a deadline that they screwed up by missing. Or, if you listen to their arguments, that the city screwed up by requiring earlier than usual, than was the case in previous ballot initiatives, but one which was publicly announced, which was on their on the city's website, and which, it isn't enough to get hundreds of thousands of dollars from out-of-city real estate profiteers. The anti-rent control people also want to get a rebuttal argument kind of woven into their initial argument. I'll explain what this means when it comes up. In fact, maybe I'll do that to begin with. We can hear a little of that. I'm not going to play a lot of it because it's available online. And for those who are interested, you can go to the City of Santa Cruz's website and go to the date, the August 7th City Council meeting, a special session, and you can actually hear it. So why not do that rather than hear it here? Although, since a lot of what I'm playing today is from, some of it is easily accessible online, but some of it's not. And I try to give you what isn't accessible online so you can have some new material. While a strong supporter of the rent control initiative, probably doesn't go far enough. It doesn't roll back rents. It essentially limits them to 2% a year and provides just eviction protection, which is very important, both of them. But the rents are so excessively high, they probably should be rolled back significantly. And until tenants get together to do that, well, we've got what we've got. However, Santa Cruz is currently under a rent freeze a partial rent freeze, which affects some renters. The state is considering sent to the voters the people signing petitions sent to the voters proposed Proposition 10, the repeal of the Costa-Hawkins bill, which would allow cities to choose to restore rent control on a number of units that they've been banned from doing that on since 1995, resulting in huge escalations in rent and fundamentally changing the population of Santa Cruz. Be nice to see some studies on that. I haven't seen that, the change in the population demographic here. Anyway, the debate at the city council was really on a technical issue, which is whether the city should allow the anti-rent control people, even though they missed the deadline, to still get in an argument, because their argument is that there was previously an understanding in all previous elections, but certainly in some of the elections, that since you're combining the city and the county's ballot measures, you would have a vote in November as a kind of a unified action, and there was the same deadline for both of them. The county deadline is later than the city one. And so the Santa Cruz Together folks and other anti-rent control people said that they claimed the clerk made a mistake in creating an earlier deadline for putting in arguments so the voters could read on the ballot pro and con on the rent control initiative. The rent control people said no, the city clerk acted according to the law. She may have acted a little unusually, but she did so either it was at the dictate of the city council or as permitted by state law. And because the rent control people noticed it and they responded to it with far less resources than the Santa Cruz Together anti-rent control people, though they have 10 times the amount of money. Santa Cruz Together insists it isn't getting outside money, but there's a lot of outside money flowing in, according to today's Sentinel, into the campaign against rent control and the vote coming up in November. So I'm going to play some of the debate, or I should say the public testimony. The outcome, of course, was the Sandy Brown caved. There were only four people at the city council sitting on to vote on this. Two of them disqualified themselves, David Terrazas, the mayor, and Chris Krohn, because of landlord conflicts of interest, or possibly the appearance of conflicts of interest. And there were four people who were actually voted on the whole thing. I'm not sure what happened to the seventh person, but it was Maxine Watkins, Rochelle Naroyan, Sandy Brown, and Cynthia Chase. And I probably got one of their names wrong, so forgive me in advance. And Brown finally realized, she gave a lot of credit to the rent control people and said she was in favor of it, and she was a renter, and she didn't have a conflict of interest, and that she'd already gotten that cleared with the political employment or the political commission covering that at the state level. But she ended up proposing a resolution that said that all sides could submit their arguments. And in a way, that sounds fair. And I initially, when I heard about all this, I thought, yeah, it's important that both sides be able to present their arguments, however much I may disagree with the anti-rent control side. But it's also true that, well, as you'll hear in some of this discussion, that those who are on the pro-rent control side pointed out quite truthfully that there's going to be a huge amount of propaganda coming at the community from the anti-rent control profiteers from out of town and from in town, and the homeowners who are concerned about, you know, losing their margin of profit, so they will lose their investments or their equity will drop or whatever you will. I kind of dismiss it. I don't own such things myself, and I don't have a lot of close connections with people who do. So maybe that biases me for sure. But it looks to me like the city is being driven into penury. Poor people are being driven away. And even people who are well-to-do can't afford to stay. The rent is just too high. The rental market is too hot. It's just a great opportunity for investment in real estate. But that's not what Santa Cruz should be about. Anyway, let's listen to some of this discussion about whether to extend the deadline. This is a proposal presented by anti-rent control mayor David Terrazas, who's also employed by the law firm that has the account of Santa Cruz Together, which is the main anti-rent control group in Santa Cruz. And that may be one of the reasons he disqualified himself. It may be not because he's a landlord, but because he's connected with a law firm that is closely connected with anti-rent control activity. And this is Acting Chair Vice Mayor Watkins, I believe. And now she begins public discussion.
Unless there are any other future comments by the council, we'll go ahead and open it up for public comment. Approximately how many folks plan to speak to this item this evening?
The organizations first.
I will call the organizations. If you wouldn't mind just leaving your hands up.
And after some discussion, she decided 2 minutes per speaker for the 200 people to speak. I don't know that many, but it was a lot of people. And 4 minutes for the groups. Here is the beginning of this discussion.
The first person to speak, and that was who, Bonnie? And Pat Colby can come up here and speak for 2 minutes.
Ooh.
Pat Colby. Okay.
Pat is disabled, so she's...
Is this the speaker I use?
Allowed to speak.
Good.
First.
Thank you for accommodating my disabilities. There's a lot of questions going around as I listened. Anthony Cadotti, do you think you could have been rescued because it's a conflict of interest? Do you own property? Are you going to make money off of the deadline and this ballot possibly getting off on the measure? Same thing with Rochelle. And I saw some of the nasty things that were sent to Sandy Brown and said about her on Nextdoor. Maybe in all conscience, you should just go ahead and recuse yourself, and then there wouldn't be enough people to vote on it. I mean, the whole thing about the rent control issue comes up because we shouldn't have to have this. We shouldn't have to have government get in the middle of rent. But unfortunately, there's been too many landlords that don't respect tenant rights or civil rights. And that's why it's here. And I, on Nextdoor, what, excuse me.
Boo.
And Nextdoor is a website where apparently Sandy Brown, council member, was attacked. And it's an anti-rent control, I presume, attack. I haven't looked at it myself.
Again, I want to remind folks to maintain respect and to listen while they have the folks that are speaking have the mic. And they'll hopefully do the same for you. So if you wouldn't mind keeping your comments to yourself as the person who is speaking before us has their time before us. Okay, you can go ahead and start it again.
Okay, thank you. Because I initially am very against rent control. Because I'm a victim of fraud being done on me, and I had just cause eviction. So these people are all worried about just cause eviction. Well, unfortunately, in this city and many cities, but this city especially, your size of justice amounts to your pocketbook. My pocketbook is empty, so I've had no justice. I'm holding out for due process because fraud was done on me. So just cause evictions aren't going to protect anyone. Only 3% of people that fight evictions win. And if you can't afford an attorney, the amount of people that win in these eviction courts is about 1%. So there's really nothing that the landlord should have to worry about.
And I guess Pat's point is that while there is a lot of protection on paper that says you can't be evicted except for a number of specific causes, you have to be able to defend that in court. When the landlord evicts you. But again, I haven't examined the rather lengthy text of the actual just cause eviction section of this rent control and just cause eviction initiative that's coming up for a vote in November. And perhaps we can get more information on that as we get closer to the election. But according to Pat here, it sounds like you're going to have to take your issue to court to win, and that takes money and lawyers. And so, that doesn't really fit the bill for most people who are renters, who are poor anyway.
But I was hoping that this could be done. This is a classist issue, and I was hoping that tenants and landlords together could come together and, you know, talk about it instead of arguing and siding class. And I'm against the deadline being...
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Okay, at this time, we would have the four groups that contacted the mayor to come up and speak. You have 4 minutes. Okay.
You got a call with the organization.
I will call. Thank you very much. I again want to remind folks to maintain respect and civil discourse. If we have to interrupt the meeting, I will have to follow our council policy and rule book around asking that you be warned. And if it continues, then we will ask that you leave in disruption of the meeting. So I again want to remind folks that we have an opportunity to hear from everybody, regardless of your agreement with their position, in a respectful way. And we will all hear everybody's comments, whether we agree or not, and try our best to be respectful. And I want to hopefully acknowledge that again and not have to do that multiple times, because I know a lot of folks want to speak tonight. So at this point, I would like to ask Lynn Renshaw to come forward, and you will have 4 minutes to speak on behalf of your organization, Santa Cruz Together. Okay. We have Robert Singleton on behalf. Okay.
Yeah, she's back there if you want to check with her. It's okay.
Okay, so Robert, you'll have 4 minutes.
Thank you very much. Good evening, Mayor, Council members. My name is Robert Singleton, and I'm the campaign manager for Santa Cruz Together, the 100% locally funded, locally managed campaign against rent control and just cause eviction measure on the November ballot. Okay. Together we represent thousands of property owners, housing providers, and yes, even tenants like myself, who believe that this measure has qualified for the ballot as both too extreme and costly and will ultimately harm more renters than it would help. However, that is not why I'm here today. Instead, I'm here on behalf of Santa Cruz Together to urge you to support the staff recommendation to extend the deadline for receiving arguments both in favor and against this measure in the interest of fairness and transparency to voters. According to the city staff report before you, a simple clerical error was made in interpreting the proper timeline listed in the state's election code as it pertains to a consolidated versus a special election. This mistake was further compounded in the public sphere due to the differences listed in the county elections guidelines versus those in the city resolution, combined with different interpretations in various local media outlets. With all that being said, it seems clear that when looking at the staff report, that an honest mistake was made and that it needs to be fixed. It's that simple. There's no use overly dwelling on it or blowing it out of proportion. These things happen. We are all human. Had this been any other item, one that didn't have two very organized and focused interest groups on different sides, this sort of mistake might have been met with a shoulder shrug and a cleanup item in a later agenda. Unfortunately, that's not the case, and here we are. If you follow staff's recommendations and extend the deadline, then both groups will have equal space in the voter pamphlet, and both sides will still be able to respond to each other's primary arguments with a rebuttal. To interpret this as anything other than fair is reaching, and to construe it as favoritism is an exercise in extraordinary cynicism. Santa Cruz Together wants equal space in the voter guide because of how complex this issue is and how dire the situation is. While rent control may sound favorable on the surface, and while some forms of rent control may actually be effective in addressing outlier rent increases, this measure is poorly written and fraught with unintended consequences that will make the affordable housing shortage worse. Rent increases can be regulated and without creating an entirely separate, independently elected board, one that is funded through additional fees on rental property to the tune of millions of dollars that can be drawn from the city's general fund. Furthermore, the just cause eviction protections, again, while well-intentioned, would open up the door for greater discrimination of those with disabilities, the elderly, and working families, and are already proven to be too risky for many housing providers to want to stay in the rental market. For many property owners, their rental unit may be the single most significant investment of their lives. The threat of having a problem tenant, or simply a tenant who needs to be bought out via hefty relocation fees, is simply too great a risk to take. This will, and already has, led to losses of rental units in the face of our already critical affordable housing shortage. But again, regardless of what you think of this measure, it doesn't change the fact that a mistake was made and that it needs to be corrected. Both sides deserve to have an equal opportunity to make their case to voters, so please support the staff recommendation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Got it. Okay, at this point, I'd like to ask Nora Hockman from the Campaign for Rent Control Movement for Housing Justice to come up, and you'll have 4 minutes as well.
Thank you. I'll probably be sharing this with someone else, so I'll race through my section, and then we'll see what happens. And there we go. So, you know, it was interesting to listen about the effect of corporate dollars in this community when it came to the sugary beverage tax, because it is the effect of those corporate dollars that's having an effect when it comes to rent control right now, because Santa Cruz Together might be a bunch of local landlords, but the California Apartment Association is not local, and neither is the State Board of Realtors, and that's who's bringing in $300,000 to this community. So let me say this about conflicts. It is our understanding that only the mayor can place items on the agenda. The mayor was conflicted out. The mayor put this item on the agenda. It is an item of conflict. We are asking for an immediate response as to whether or not this item itself is a conflict. And once we get that response, we'll continue with our presentation. But if we could have the clock go off while those minds think about it, that'd be great.
If you could pause the thing. Time we hear from you and don't have questions or dialogue, but we will write down that question and revisit it later when we have an opportunity to hear back from the council. So at this point, the attorney won't be responding to the question at the time, and you can continue with your 4 minutes.
So we're just
going
to say it is improper that there's a discussion taking place right now about this item because it was improperly placed on this agenda. Before I turn it over to my colleague, let me just say that I went to testify about housing this morning in front of an all-male, all-white Board of Supervisors. This is at least a great respite from that. So we ask you to think very wisely. On June 26th, your council set a date for a ballot statement to be entered. That date was July 10th. The Campaign for Rent Control submitted its statement. The other side didn't, for whatever reason. We were not confused. The clerk was very clear about the date. it troubles us that she is now somehow taking a fall for this. Didn't bother us. We just had to write a statement very quickly and get it turned in. We don't really understand why the other side couldn't do that, given their $400,000 and endless attorneys and consultants, but they didn't get it in. If you issue another date, we will meet this one. They are encouraged to do so because you only get one bite of this apple. Zav?
Greetings, Council, everyone here. Thanks for everyone for taking the time today. My name is Zav Hirschfield. I work at the Movement for Housing Justice. I'm a volunteer tenant advocate in the community. So I'm going to rush through this. But I have a question about fairness here. I mean, something that is being raised by the opposition to rent control is that it's not fair for them not to receive their ballot argument. As my colleague said, we met our deadline. They did not. They have plenty of money available to them to reach voters in the city. I'm not sure who's seen the, how do you pronounce it, Skacky? Sketchy? I don't know. Sketchy. Oh, thank you. The sketchy mailer that arrived at thousands of voter doors some weeks ago, sent by a CAA-funded front group. I have very little doubt that they're going to be able to reach voters. But I don't want to talk about that for the moment. I want to talk about harm. I want to talk about what it means for the council to offer special benefits to one side in a democratic contest. I spoke with a tenant today who lives in Boulder Creek, who's facing a rent increase that his voucher will not pay for. Without rent control, people in similar situations to him will face houselessness all over the city. I encourage you to consider them and the actual harm it will do to their lives.
Thank you for your comments. Okay, at this point, I'd like to invite up Cynthia Berger for her 4 minutes. And Cynthia, you're with the Santa Cruz Tenants Association, I have.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Let me just put my quote here so I can see it. It keeps disappearing. All right. Thank you. I'm Cynthia Berger with Santa Cruz Tenants Association. As a tenant, I live with deadlines. Tenants live with deadlines that have real consequences. If I don't pay my rent, that's immediate grounds for a 3-day pay or quit notice. The vast majority of tenants hew to this law, and that's why tenants paying rent on time makes the rental market work. That's why we have a rental market, because tenants pay their rent. If that was a big problem, well, we wouldn't have a rental market. So perhaps that's why our group paid really close attention to the publicly posted deadline to submit our ballot argument. Nor did we complain that the deadline was too early for us to comply with. This rich opposition closing in on $500,000, apparently all this money leads to carelessness in following the rules. I would like to leave you with a quote. The law in its majestic equality forbids the rich as well as the poor to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal bread. Thank you.
Are you speaking also on behalf of the Santa Cruz Tenants Association? Oh, okay. Did you pause the time?
Okay, can you hear me now?
We can hear you now.
You are not going to be able to see me, but you can hear me now. Okay, good evening. It's very little I can add to what Nora and Cynthia say so far. The only comment I want to make to you is that, and I'm making this comment because I know that you, Martin, and you, Cynthia, really care for families. And that's why I'm going to make this comment. One of the landlords who signed the petition when I was asking for signatures, he started arguing with me about that was how unfair was what we were asking for. And my response was that if they had policing themselves, we won't be in the situation we were. We won't be having to talk to in favor of people who are living in a very horrible housing situations or paying 90% of their income into rent. And this is, again, one of those issues where if they had been policing themselves, we won't be here. Tenant Sanctuary is working right now with six different tenants in six different apartment complexes where the rent has been increased $200 and one of them for $400. With the ordinance in place, this is keep happening because the landlords are failing to be checking themselves and being more human about what is happening right now.
And what Ernestina, what she is saying is that there is currently a rent control ordinance and emergency rent freeze in place, but some landlords are still raising rents and ignoring the law.
Okay. Just as Cynthia say, if I don't pay my rent on time, I don't have a second deadline. I will be receiving a notice that I'm not paying, and from then on. So why they could not comply with what we were able to comply? Are we better? Are we smarter? Or what is the issue? I believe we are talking about people who are very, you know, intelligent and human. And so why they have to get a special treatment when we did not? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So our next speaker will be from the Students Uniting with Renters. Is a representative from that organization prepared to speak on their behalf? Okay. You'll have 4 minutes.
Good evening, Mayor and Council members. My name is Brennan, and I am a member of Students United with Renters, a community group that aims to build renter power and raise public awareness about housing inequality and tenants' rights. We are students and non-students, all experiencing in some capacity the injustice of the Santa Cruz rental housing market. And yes, we support rent control. Today, we are demanding that the City Council act to protect democracy and the fairness of the election process by not granting a special extended deadline for rent control opponents and by ensuring that Fair Political Practices Commission standards are met before making this decision. There have been some astounding examples of inequality in this initiative battle, and they are visible in this sudden proposal to grant a deadline extension. First, it is an unfair advantage for rent control opponents to be able to read our argument and then have weeks to create a supposedly original argument that is in fact a rebuttal. And the effect of this would be to give our opposition two rebuttals to our one. Instead of following the procedure that was contained in the ordinance that this council approved, publicly posted on the city clerk's website, and posted on the city hall bulletin board, opponents are seeking to use their connections with the council to change the rules after the process has already concluded. The mayor's sentinel editorial against rent control, his membership in Santa Cruz Together, and his law firm's hastily written letter in support of the deadline extension show that even when one is supposed to recuse themselves from such matters, they can still find ways to have what may be an unethical influence on this process. This is why we are demanding an FPPC ruling on whether the mayor acted legally in placing this item on tonight's agenda, as well as a ruling on the fairness of the proposed process. We believe that the best way for the City Council to remain neutral as a government body is not to interfere with the process on anyone's behalf. Santa Cruz voters this November will remember your decision as an indication of which council members support truly unbiased elections. Further, campaign finance reports show that rent control opponents will not struggle to get out their message. The Sacramento-based California Apartment Association, the Sacramento-based California Association of Realtors, and the Chicago-based National Association of Realtors, statewide and nationwide organizations, have already raised more than $300,000 to fight this local measure. They have hired multiple consultants, seasoned campaign managers, and advertisers of all kinds, and they will clearly have the resources to bombard Santa Cruz voters with their arguments this fall. You'd think that the least they could do with this kind of financial support is to meet their deadlines. We want this election to be conducted under a transparent, fair, and democratic process. That's only possible when you establish a set of rules to govern everyone on every side of the campaign and then stick to them. Democracy means that everyone abides by the same process. There aren't two sets of rules, one for people who have the ear of the mayor and council and one for everyone else. In conclusion, we hope that you consider these power imbalances when carrying out your decision. Rent control opponents will have you believing that it is the city's fault for their mistake. We are demanding that you keep the rules the same for everyone and preserve the original deadline. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that is the last of the organizations that reached out to us to ask for extra time. So at this time, we'll move to just general public comment. You'll have 2 minutes to speak to the council. And if you are interested in speaking, please line up on my left. And go ahead, Mike.
And it's about time for a musical break. So let's break. Here's Red Shadow, one of my favorite tunes. You may have heard it before.
Well, suburbs sprawl and traffic crawls. Is this the way you want it to be? Some folks choke and it's no joke. We will change it politically. A common decision must now be made. A union of many voices. That the life we lead fills a corporate need. And gives hopeless illusions of joy. Saying the ship is sinking awfully fast. I feel the waters rising, my friend. This ship is sinking, it won't last. Only you can tell us how it will end. From Arab sands and Texas lands, the same hands they're controlling the flow. Offshore rigs and strip mine digs. It's these rigs who tell you where it will go. They won't give you the sun or the wind when it runs. It only would show up as losses. But it's cheap and it's neat and it provides you with heat. But it doesn't require no bosses. Sing, this ship is sinking awfully fast. I feel the waters rising, my friend. This ship is sinking, it won't last. Only you can tell us how it will end.
That was Red Shadow, the Economics Rock and Roll Band. The original LP was in the 70s, and this version was done again in the 80s, or at least released then. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. The show is recorded, but if you have comments or you want to have your thoughts broadcast on the air or just known to me, give me a call at 423-4833, 423-4833, area code 831. You can also reach me by email at rnorse3@hotmail.com. So I was going to continue and may later in the show with the second half of the CPRB hearing, Citizens Police Review Board hearing on the very important and still grossly present selective enforcement practices of the Santa Cruz Police Department. But this is Nagasaki Day, the day that the U.S., for a second time, and it has been the only power to explode a nuclear weapon on a civilian or even just a human population. So I'm going to play something that kind of bears on this. It's the audio portion of a video entitled What Happened to the Nuclear Test Sites? Because even after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, when no further A-bombs or H-bombs were dropped on human populations, endless testing went on the building up of nuclear weapons, and more such testing continues, or at least certainly the creation of more nuclear weapons continues under Obama and Trump. And we need to know what happened to people as a consequence of the nuclear tests. This is by a fellow named Paul Shilto, and it's the video is, of course, more striking than the audio, but the audio is articulate enough to be appropriate, and this may be one of the appropriate days to air it. It was it's an older audio. It was published in March of this year, but I think it predates that. What happened to nuclear test sites?
Since the formation of the United States, its mainland has never been invaded or had any major attack. But there are places there which have had more nuclear explosions than anywhere else on Earth. Of the 1,054 US nuclear tests, 928 were carried out on the US mainland, mostly at the Nevada test site. But it wasn't just the US testing nukes. The Soviets, British, French, Chinese, Indian and Pakistanis, and more recently the North Koreans, have all tested nuclear weapons, some on their own territory and some in remote locations around the world, in the air, on the land, underwater and even in space. But by far, it's the US and the Soviets that were the biggest players. But what happened at and to the nuclear test sites? The very first full-scale nuclear test was the Trinity explosion of May 16, 1945 at the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. This was to prove the theories developed by the Manhattan Project would actually work in reality. Trinity was an implosion device that used plutonium. This was in response to the original design, which was a gun-type device that used uranium-235. But at the time, uranium-235 had to be refined almost an atom at a time, and even using the massive X-10 graphite reactor at the newly constructed Oak Ridge National Laboratory, it would take years to get enough uranium-235 for just one bomb. Plutonium could be made much easier in a reactor. But in order to make it become critical and an explosive device, a ball of it would have to be compressed to about half its size with an explosive lens. And this is what the Trinity test was all about. As the bomb exploded, the 30-meter metal tower, its support structure, and the bomb casing itself was vaporized along with the sand of the desert floor below. As the vaporized material cooled and fell back to the ground, it became a green glassy mineral, now called trinitite. In some of the greenish glass, there are patches of red, which is thought to be the copper wire which was used to trigger the explosive lens. Just after the war, samples of trinitite were sold as jewelry because it was thought that the fireball had just melted the sand and that it wasn't particularly radioactive. Though now it's illegal to take samples from the site, which is open to the public twice a year. The level of radiation at the Trinity Ground Zero site is now, approximately for 1 hour of exposure, about the same as the average US citizen would get per day from natural radiation sources. Following the war, nuclear testing moved to the Nevada Proving Grounds, about 100 kilometers northwest of Las Vegas. From 1951 until 1962, 100 above-ground tests were performed, becoming a bit of a tourist attraction in Las Vegas, where they could feel the seismic shockwave through the ground and see the mushroom cloud rising in the distance. At the time, even though the effects of radiation were becoming much more well known, little was done to reduce the fallout. But it wasn't just bombs which they tested. The government wanted to know how buildings, infrastructure, and people might fare if there was a nuclear attack. So they built typical American houses, fully furnished. Industrial buildings, parts of bridges, electrical supply stations, even bank vaults in the test zone, and exploded nuclear devices nearby. They tested different types of concrete and building materials to see which would be more resilient. In fact, many of the building codes now in use today are based on the results of these nuclear tests. As part of the government's attempts to reassure the public that things like their money and valuable documents and records would be safe in the event of a nuclear attack, Edwin Mosler, the president of the Mosler Safe Company, whose biggest customer was the government, built an armoured vault on the Frenchman Flats test area near a 37-kiloton test to prove that it would withstand the heat and blast, which it did. And it's still there today, minus the door, which was removed afterwards. Airbursts are considered cleaner than ones just above the ground, because if the fireball reaches the ground, soil and other materials are sucked up into the fireball and mixed with the nuclear elements to make a highly radioactive cloud that can travel for hundreds of kilometers. In 1953, a 32-kiloton device nicknamed Harry was detonated. The device later became known as Dirty Harry because this test generated more fallout than any other US continental test. Due to an error and an unexpected change in the wind direction, the fallout was blown over 200 kilometers and over the city of St. George, Utah, where the people said there was an oddly metallic sort of taste in the air. But the prevailing winds carried the fallout from many of the Nevada tests over southern Utah. But the effects were spread across much of the mid-US, affecting over 3,000 counties and causing a marked increase in the number of cancers from the mid-1950s up until the early 1980s. As of 2014, the US government had approved 28,880 claims for a total of $1.9 billion in compensation to servicemen at the test ranges and to the public who had been exposed to radioactive fallout. Because of the Partial Test Ban Treaty of 1963, atmospheric tests were banned and all testing went underground. The thinking was that if the test could be contained deep underground, there would be little or no fallout. But they could still contaminate underground water sources if poorly located. In this shot of the area from Google Earth, each one of the small circular marks is a subsidence crater formed as a result of an underground test. Some 828 were done this way. The biggest of these, which can be seen unaided from space, was part of Operation Plowshare, to see if nuclear devices could be used in the peaceful use of excavating large areas of land quickly. The Sedan Crater, which is 100 meters deep and 390 meters across, was formed by a 104-kiloton device detonated 194 meters underground in July 1962. The test displaced 11 million tons of soil, but the fallout, which spread northeastwards in two separate clouds as far as Iowa, was found to be too highly radioactive to make this a practical, peaceful use of nuclear explosions, in the US at least. But it has believed to have been used in the Soviet Union. Today, the crater can be visited and the levels of radiation are safe enough as not to warrant any protective clothing. However, in the Soviet Union at this time, there was less of a concern for the health and safety of the rural population of Kazakhstan near the Semipalatinsk test site, which was also known as the Polygon. The test site was created as a top priority on the orders of Stalin by the Marshal of the Soviet Union and head of the NKVD secret police, Lavrenty Beria, in 1947. The facilities were built on an 18,000 square kilometer area of a steppe in northeastern Kazakhstan with gulag forced labor in what Beria said was uninhabited land, but actually had around about a million people living within a 160 kilometer radius of the site, and had many villages much closer. Between 1949 and 1989, 456 tests were performed. Of that, 116 were above ground, either airdropped or on towers, the last of which occurred in 1962. The total yield of the tests over the site's 40-year history is equivalent to about 400 Hiroshima-sized bombs, or about 6 megatons. After the collapse of the Soviet Union and Kazakhstan became a separate country, the area was neglected, and nuclear materials were left unguarded in mountain tunnels and boreholes, many of which were targeted by scavengers looking for scrap metal, but not necessarily knowing what they were picking up. The significant amounts of plutonium left behind were considered to be one of the biggest nuclear security threats, and in 2012, Russian, US and Kazakh scientists completed a secret 17-year, $150 million cleanup operation to make the site safe, which included things like filling boreholes and tunnels with special concrete but chemically bonded with plutonium. It's only in the last few years that the scale of the radiation damage has come to light. The Soviet state covered up the extent of the damage for decades, and it wasn't until 1956 that any studies were conducted into the effects on the local population. The Institute of Radiation Medicine and Ecology in Semi, or what was known as Semipalatinsk, has said that between 500,000 and 1 million people were exposed to substantial radiation doses when the atmospheric tests were being carried out, which led to a dramatic increase in cancer, birth defects, and mortality from the effects of radiation. You can find out more in the report by the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs at the address shown now, and also in the description. But for the biggest Soviet tests, they needed somewhere even more remote. Novaya Zemlya is a crescent-shaped island group in the Arctic Ocean off of the northern coast of Russia. There are three test zones on the islands, zones A, B and C. It's most famous for being the place where the largest ever nuclear test took place on October the 31st, 1961, when the Tsar Bomber, a 50 megaton nuclear device, was dropped over test zone C. Originally designed to have a yield of 100 megatons, it was scaled back because of fears of the large amount of fallout it would create, and that the plane carrying the bomb would not be able to escape the fireball in time. Even with a 50 megaton blast, the specially modified Tu-95V was only given a 50% chance of survival. The Tsar bomber was detonated at 14,000 feet, 4,260 meters, creating a fireball 8 kilometers across, but it was stopped from reaching the ground by its own huge shockwave reflected back from the ground. The release plane managed to get 45 kilometers away before the detonation, but it still dropped a kilometer in the air due to the shockwave. However, it made it back to base safely, and the pilot flying the plane resigned from the Air Force shortly after the test. The explosion was so large that the fireball was visible over 1,000 kilometers away. Every building within a 55 kilometer radius was destroyed. Wooden houses in districts hundreds of kilometers away were destroyed, and stone ones had their roofs blown off and windows and doors blown in. The mushroom cloud reached an altitude of 65 kilometers, or 213,000 feet, seven times the height of Everest, and the heat from the fireball could create third-degree burns 100 kilometers away. This wasn't the only test carried out at Novaya Zemlya. There were 224 nuclear detonations with a total yield of 265 megatons. That's 132 times more than the total amount of munitions used by all sides during World War II, including the two atomic bombs on Japan. The last nuclear test was carried out there in 1990, and today it's still a military test area, although mostly a barren Arctic island. Visitors there have found only slightly raised levels of radiation, but access to the main test sites is not possible. For the larger US tests, they also used remote islands and atolls, but this time in the South Pacific. Testing started there in 1948, after the islands came under control of the US as part of the Trust Territory of the Pacific Islands, and by 1962, 105 atmospheric and underwater tests had been carried out. The first ever test after Trinity and Japanese atomic bombs was to find out if Navy ships could withstand a nuclear attack. Operation Crossroads was performed in a lagoon at Bikini Atoll because of its remote location, suitable weather, and only a small population of 167 people, which were relocated. The Galapagos Islands had also been considered as a possible nuclear test site. The test was witnessed by invited members of the press and the public. Over 90 ships, including captured German, Japanese, and surplus US ships, would make up the test fleet in the lagoon. This was to be a three-bomb test. The first, being called Able, was an airdrop exploding 158 meters above the fleet, with the following tests being underwater. All three bombs were to be the same as the 23-kiloton Fat Man implosion bomb dropped on Nagasaki. The Able test was hampered by the bomb being 650 meters off target. Five ships were sunk and 14 seriously damaged. The second test, called Baker, was an underwater test, the first time that this had occurred. It created a host of effects, many of which had never been seen before, but the biggest was the fact that it made the sea in the lagoon highly radioactive. The radiation was so bad that many of the ships could not be decontaminated, but some in the Navy didn't believe the problem was real. It was only when a Navy surgeon retrieved a fish from a lagoon and placed it next to a piece of photographic film which it exposed that they decided to cancel the third test. Only five ships were able to be used after the test, and the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, Glenn T. Seaborg, called it the world's first nuclear disaster. In 1952, the first hydrogen bomb test, codenamed Ivy Mike, took place at the bigger Eniwetok Atoll, 320 kilometres east of Bikini. This wasn't so much a bomb as a scientific experiment, as the hydrogen fuel had to be cooled with a massive cryogenic plant. When it was detonated, it produced a yield of 10.4 megatons. But over 8 megatons of that came from the fast fission of the uranium tamper, which created a huge amount of fallout and an underwater crater 1.9 kilometers wide and 50 meters deep. By 1954, the hydrogen bomb had been refined to become a device that could be dropped from a plane. And on the 28th of February, the first of six bomb tests were carried out as part of Operation Castle at Bikini Atoll. The Castle Bravo test was estimated to have a yield of 6 megatons, but due to an unexpectedly high performance of the lithium-7 in the design, it actually had a yield of 15 megatons, and to this day is the largest US nuclear explosion. Because of the much greater power, the fallout was much more than expected, with highly radioactive calcium from the vaporized coral reef below the bomb, not only covering the Bikini Atoll itself, but also blowing eastwards and contaminating other atolls, where both US personnel and islanders were residing at the time. A Japanese fishing boat was also caught in the fallout, and one member of the crew died of radiation sickness a few days afterwards. To this day, Bikini Atoll is still heavily contaminated, and crops grown there are not safe to eat. At Eniwetok, a crater on the small island of Runit, which had been formed by a bomb test, was used by the US to dump contaminated topsoil and radioactive debris, including plutonium, from a bomb that failed to explode correctly. Starting in 1977, 4,000 US servicemen worked for 3 years to clean up the area and then cover the waste with a concrete dome. However, this was only meant to be a temporary measure until something more permanent could be arranged, and only 4 out of the 40 islands contaminated were cleaned. Because of this, the bottom of the test crater was not lined with concrete, and so now, with rising sea levels caused by climate change, seawater is seeping inside through the porous bedrock into the dome and leaching out radioactive material. But the seabed of the Eniwetok Lagoon is actually as radioactive as the material under the dome. It's been estimated that it will cost nearly $1 billion to clean up the area effectively, and instead it's proposed that contaminated areas be treated with potassium, which would only cost around about $100 million. Many of the US servicemen that built the dome and worked on the cleanup claimed they were not told they would be cleaning up radioactive waste and were not given proper training or protective clothing. In the decades since the end of the cleanup, many have died of cancer and had other health problems which they say is related to their exposure to the radiation. However, because they were not at the test sites when the tests were being performed, the US government says they are not eligible for compensation. The full effects of nuclear testing are difficult to quantify, but there has been a growing body of evidence over the last 60 years or so. Whichever way you look at it, every nuclear power put the development of increasingly more devastating weapons ahead of the health and safety of not only their own people, but also many others for generations to come who were far removed from the political decision makers. And that is the legacy of the nuclear test sites. In 1991, a study by the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, the IPPNW, estimated that by the year 2000, 430,000 cancer deaths would have been related to atmospheric testing, and concluded that eventually about 2.4 million deaths would be the result of the nuclear tests. So what are your thoughts on the issues of nuclear tests and the effects they've had and are still having? Let me know in the comments below. And also don't forget to subscribe, thumbs up, and share the video, please. Although the tests were the practical demonstration of the theories, the ideas themselves came from the brightest minds in maths and physics, using nothing more than slide rules and blackboards. But even the best had to start somewhere. If you want to develop your intuition in maths and science, then you need to check this out. This is from Brilliant, an interactive problem-solving website where you can solve real-world problems and learn to think like a scientist.
And to get deeper into that, you can go to, browse for what happened to the nuclear test sites on YouTube, or just in any browser, and you'll get to this video, which also has some interesting video visual displays, but I think you've caught the gist of it. And now a little music to lighten the mood or maybe intensify the terror. Let's see how it works.
Day. It's Christmas at Ground Zero, just second.
That was Weird Al Yankovic, permanent record Christmas at Ground Zero. So now we're going to return to the 2002 Citizens Review Board, kind of a historic one that we heard the first half of, which concerned itself with how are the police acting toward poor people, people of color, people who are alternate culture, political activists. Is there a selective enforcement happening around laws? And, of course, most of us who live here know that that is not just the common practice, but it's also the laws were intended and created with just that understanding in mind. In fact, former Mayor Mike Rutkin actually said as much when he supported the downtown ordinances, the laws that make it a crime to be seated within 14 feet of a building, bench, street corner, phone booth or phone kiosk, statue, everywhere except on about 1% of the sidewalk. It's a crime to sit down unless you're sitting at a bench, and then you can only be there for an hour. A whole series of ordinances that are intended to give the police sort of maximum flexibility in enforcing a law to find you guilty of something if you don't do what they say. So let's hear more of this hearing, and that may take up the rest of the show, or I may be interrupting it with my own comments and some other items as well. But let's begin. So a reminder, the Citizens Police Review Board is considering a proposal made by activist Sherry Connable, the peace activist, who's also been concerned with homeless civil rights, that the city council make it a clear police policy that selective enforcement is a no-no. That's the shorthand for what this proposal was.
Hello, my name is Frank Avila, and I'm a transient. And there's an incident 2 weeks ago where a young man stole a CD from Borders, and he was running out, and he was attacked by a Borders employee and beat up. There was blood, and a homeless man saw this going down, and he interceded on behalf of the young man who stole a CD to save him. He was screaming for help, and he pulled him off and just held the employee from Borders and till he calmed down, and then the employee went back into Borders. Now, as the young man, the homeless man, helped the young man off, the young man left, and the homeless man was walking up the street, and the employee from Borders started flipping him off, and he came out and he started a fight with him, and the homeless man was trying to leave, get past the employee, and the employee from Borders put his hands on him and grabbed him, and he kind of slightly shoved him out of the way and kept walking. And the employee for Borders just started cussing really loud. And I was walking by, and I had seen it go down, and I told him, shut up. And he got mad at me and started cussing at me and threatening me until he saw two police officers walking by. One of them is Baker. And he goes up to Baker, and he starts talking to him. And Baker comes to me, and he's like, well, this young man says that this homeless kid threatened him. Where is he? And three other policemen and policewomen showed up, and they actively walked up and down the street searching for this homeless man. And I tried to give my account of what happened and was disregarded and laughed at and ignored until this wealthy, well-dressed young woman comes up to Baker and corroborated my testimony. And after that, it came to light that it was the young man from Borders who was initiating the fight. And As soon as that came about, he told the young man from Borders to go into the store, and that was it. He left. That's my account.
Thank you. Next speaker, please.
Hi, my name is Yonko. I'm another person working with Downtown for All. I also work with Food Not Bombs and a number of different groups around. Use of force policy. I would really like it, but to see the Santa Cruz Police Department have a really serious use of force policy where we really have some idea and they don't just have full discretion to go after and use force to anyone they want. I would really like to see that. I'm fully in support of Sherry Connable's resolution. That sounded like a really good idea. Also the things that Thomas Levitt and Steve Argue had said. In terms of specific incidences of harassment and selective enforcement, I'll just mention a few. In early June, another Food Not Bombs issue is off, and then he hadn't done anything in terms of any like trying to strike them or anything. He was just shouldering off them because they were grabbing him. At that point, Baker struck Freeburg right in the right side of his ribcage. I was watching this. There were a number of other witnesses that you could talk to. There's lots of this evidence around. I don't know how much you folks have the power to do with it. I hope you have more than I think. 2 weeks ago, several people, I'm just trying to think of incidences that haven't already been mentioned, but 2 weeks ago, several people were harassed, three people for pushing shopping carts up and down the Pacific Avenue area. Thomas Levitt is another example, and he's on November 5th, actually, he's going to be in court in Department 2 at 8:30. He's gotten 4 jaywalking tickets.
November 1st.
Oh, it's November 1st. Okay, that's good. I'm totally wrong on that. All right, other ones. I didn't have much time to put this together, unfortunately. So I'm just going to look here. You already heard about a lot of this. I don't think there's really much more I can say that hasn't been said.
Just get your name again.
Yaakov. It's Y-A-C-O-V. And, I've got evidence to give to you. I can give a phone number out or email. And, also reachable through Downtown for All contact.
Do you have the contact, do you have the address and phone number of the CPRB?
Yeah. If you can just start sending that to you.
Yes, you do have the address, right?
I can get it.
Okay.
I can get it. Thank you.
Another speaker, please.
Good evening. My name is Jennifer Gosk, and I'd like to make a statement of account of witnessing Mr. Steve Argue get arrested for his jaywalking offenses that he had incurred, I guess, 4 times. And I would say the lunacy behind seeing Merry Mondays being perpetrated by extra police officers that really have no business being there is the same account of watching approximately 4 or 5 police officers come to take Steve away for a jaywalking offense. And I remember when they came up to the parking lot when we were walking back to getting our breakfast in the morning. And it was almost like it was a surrounding formation as we walked back and we came to the parking lot to get into my car. And when they handcuffed him, they were putting him in the squad car, and I realized, I looked and I said to one of the officers, "This is for jaywalking, right? This is for jaywalking?" They said, "This is for jaywalking." They put him in the car, and he was taken away. But I did not think that jaywalking was an arrestable offense.
Thank you. Are there no more speakers? If not, I would like to hear Ms. Remaster read the letter.
Thank you.
And tell us what's wrong, please.
The woman describes herself as from Chris Fredrickson. So more about her in the letter. It's addressed to you, Mark, and the CPRB. Regarding the public hearing at this date, as I am unable to attend the public hearing this evening, I am writing on behalf of both myself and a large sector of the homeless population, whose testimony will not be heard tonight because they were not duly given notice of this hearing. I have a formerly homeless woman who spent 7 months living in Camp Paradise. Rather than send my testimony as to the police harassment which I experienced on the streets, particularly by Eric Seeley, I'd very much like to give it in person. Additionally, I have spoken to many people in and around the Homeless Resource Center who had no notice of this hearing but who would like to testify as to their experiences. These conversations took place today. Consequently, and since this is a portion of the population which comes into almost daily contact with the SCPD, I believe it crucial to the purposes of this proceeding that they be heard from. To that end, please continue this hearing for another week or month or whatever can be arranged so that these people can come in and give testimony. Thank you for your time and consideration. And I'll give this to your staff. As those of you, several of you who know who work with homeless people now, they have to roll up the streets and disappear before 4:30 on most days if they want any shelter.
What's the name of the author of the letter?
Chris Fredrickson. And she's attached her business card here to the letter I'll give you if you want more information.
Thank you. Okay, I want to ask if there's anyone else who hasn't spoken before at this time on this issue.
This actually was Linda Lemaster you just heard, essentially conveying information from Chris Fredrickson, who was a, I think that's who it was, who was a resident of Camp Paradise, a homeless camp that existed in 2001, generally between, from the spring through the winter, until it was washed away by a flood, and the city did not allow it to be recreated, or it was unsuccessful in recreating itself.
I'm going to add to the board. Our agenda says that the recommendations for the CPRB to make a recommendation and or comment to city council, city manager, and chief of police based on the information presented. I'd like to open up to discussion, if there's any discussion among the board on what we've heard.
I have a question from the police liaison.
Okay, Newkin.
My question is, what can you tell us about complaints regarding Merry Mondays and the activities?
This is Jim King, a conservative member of the board, asking the police officer
who's sitting on
this hearing
about police presence at Merry Mondays. Fourth and Monday down at the intersection of Cooper Street and Pacific Avenue.
Merry Mondays was a political event which Huff and other organizations, another one was called Downtown for All, formed to fight the expansion of the anti-homeless, anti-performer downtown ordinances, and also to raise political issues for the upcoming November election. This particular CPRB hearing was held on October 14th, 2002, a month or a couple of weeks before the election. Jim King, who's asking the question of what can you tell us about police surveillance of Merry Mondays, it's got a bad reputation in my book as both a CPRB member, a member of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. There's a shelter board for a while that tried to create a different, more expansive shelter. He opposed it, I believe. Well, you might say he took positions that I didn't agree with, and his his term on the CPRB was not particularly distinguished. Of course, few of them were, it's true, because they mostly they felt hidebound by the rules, but a lot of them were concerned with giving the police the benefit of the doubt, it seemed like. Very few police department internal investigation findings were overturned. When a complaint was filed, the police department would look at the complaint and they would supposedly investigate it and then come up with a finding, unfounded, exonerated, unsustained, or sustained. Sustained was the only designation that meant anything, really. Police department found almost no complaints sustained. I don't have the actual figures with me. And the CPRB just sort of followed suit. They were the tail wagged by the police dog, or at least so it seemed to a lot of us, or the toy poodle, as we called it, instead of the watchdog.
I realize that you perhaps had no advance knowledge of this particular testimony, but I thought you may have heard perhaps some information about complaints from anyone about activities occurring during that time at that location.
What King is doing here is he's suggesting that the activities occurring at Merry Monday, it sounds like to me, he's wondering if the Merry Monday activists, it sounds like that's the impression I'm getting listening to him talk, although I don't remember my feelings. I was in the room at the time. In other words, turning the tables, it's not the police to be blamed, but it was those Merry Monday people that were the problem. But I could be wrong. It could be he was actually genuinely trying to find out if there was any problems. But if he's asking the police department if there were complaints against them, it's really sort of irrelevant because it was in those days, it was the Citizens Police Review Board that got all the complaints. They were filed through the Citizens Police Review Board often, or it reached them in any case. So to ask this officer what was going on Merry Mondays, which was a forum every Monday when people performed and gave out speeches and urged changes in the law and talked about incidences of bad police conduct or merchant abuse and discrimination. But there were always an unusual number of police officers, six police often standing on an opposite corner observing sometimes, I believe videoing. On several occasions, they came in to arrest a person who was lying on the sidewalk because the person sat down. It was a disabled person, actually, at that time. It was many of us viewed police response to Merry Mondays as a form of harassment. King's perspective seemed to be the opposite, or trying to show that it was Merry Mondays that was somehow at fault, and the police were not doing, taking, I don't know, positive or acceptable action. Let's hear more.
Are you talking about
citizen complaints? Yes. To the police department.
Yes. So I did receive a complaint, as you know. It occurred on Monday, and several people spoke on it, and that was Mr. Creeper.
This is a police officer. I think it's Officer McMahon, who is a comrade in arms of Officer Butchie Baker, or Sergeant Baker, I believe, at that time. And she's hard to hear, so. In fact, it sounds like the rest of this tape.
No complaints about particular speaking or political activity or loud talking or anything like that.
You're talking about a citizen complaint?
Yes, to the police department.
A citizen complaining about the police?
Mm-hmm. No, about complaining to the police about other activities.
I've done no complaints on that, and I have no idea. I'd like to, if there are, I mean, I wonder why the police come to the Merry Mondays, if it isn't for complaints. I've walked by there on Mondays and seen that there are usually four policemen.
And it really sounds like we're going to have to leave this one because it's, the original part of this tape was audible. This is not really. The woman speaking is a CPRB member named Hillary Ham, I believe. Probably I might be mixing up her name, but and if you if selective enforcement is an issue that interests you, you can hear the first part of this audio, which is much more audible and much more eloquent and actually involved people making complaints about behavior by the police, something familiar to regular listeners on this show, by going back to the Sunday, August 5th show, and you'll be able to hear more of that. And actually, though the quality is bad, I was reviewing a little bit more of this CPRB hearing tape, and a number of members of the board, including the chair, Mark Halfmoon, and it could have been that I'm really doing Jim King wrong here. I'm basing a lot of my analysis on his previous behavior that I have a fragmentary recollection of. It's almost 20 years ago now. But the rest of the board, and I don't know if he was really singling himself out on the other side, wanted to know why so many police officers were hanging around a political event on Monday if there were no actual complaints that she was aware of. And one of the board members asks if Officer McMahon got the next roll call meeting of the police department in the morning, can find out if people on Monday are given instructions to particularly pay attention to Merry Monday or expect trouble or go down there to, I don't know, defend the parking meters, whatever. Actually, I don't think there were any parking meters at that point there. But anyway, there's more, but I'll have to see if it's worth playing. But again, the reason this is important in some way is for those who want to know the history of how the police review in Santa Cruz essentially was created with a rousing cry by a number of groups in the wake of the Butchie Baker scandal. That was the 1992 claim of 9 or 10 women that he had inappropriately touched or molested them in searches, which became an issue of a scandal when the city's own Commissioner for the Prevention of Violence Against Women raised the issue, but was suppressed by the city manager and the city council. And Butchie Baker, as he's called, Lauren Baker, as he was known more officially, the same guy who was shot dead in the incident, I think in 2013 or thereabouts, along with Officer Butler, and thereafter has received a hero's halo, inappropriately, because he was a horrible officer in terms of how he treated poor and homeless people generally. The department itself gets no laurels, but he was particularly bad. And as you can even hear from just a couple of instances mentioned in this 2002 hearing. Anyway, it's for about 8 years, when this board existed from 1994 through 2002, the board was essentially a fig leaf for the police department until the very end, when you had the chair who was African American, another African American member on the board, another outspoken, I don't know if I'd call him an activist, but he questioned a lot of issues, wanted to know about use of force. All these things resulted in the final days of the board, and them, as I said before, sending a resolution to the city council, essentially asking that the city council support a dictate to the police department that they not selectively enforce policies downtown, which is pretty lukewarm in a way, but another way acknowledges that there's a problem that's been happening there. And of course, as I said before, that resulted in, never got to the city council. The new mayor, who was Emily Riley, refused to put it on the agenda. And the Citizens Police Review Board itself, without warning, was simply, its funding was cut, and it was disbanded in January of 2003, 2 months after this happened, actually 3 months after this happened. And now, because we're talking cops, here's the other recording that I wanted to play. Suggestions from an attorney on how to deal with the police. So this is James Joseph Duane, an American law professor at the Regent University School of the Law, former criminal defense attorney, and Fifth Amendment expert, according to, I think it's Wikipedia, I'm not sure. He received some viral online attention for this Don't Talk to the Police video, and we're listening to the audio, part of the audio portion of this lecture he gave to a group of law students with the Virginia Beach Police Department officer George Bruck. And they explain in practical terms why citizens should never talk to the police under any circumstances. In their view, I take a different view, but it's certainly worth listening to. And here it is.
I was invited to give you a taste of a typical law school classroom experience here today, and I thought I would take advantage of this opportunity to do something that's been on my mind for a while, to stand up and to proudly say, God bless America, God bless the Bill of Rights, and thank God for the Fifth Amendment. I'm not ashamed to say I'm proud of the Fifth Amendment, and I'm proud to admit on camera and on the Internet that I will never talk to any police officer under any circumstances, with all due respect, sir. I'm doing something really extraordinary here today, something you'll almost never see another law professor do as long as you live. I'm really putting myself on the spot here. This was my idea. By my invitation, I have given up half of my time, approximately. I'm giving equal time and the last word to an expert who really knows something about what I'll be talking about. So I'm opening myself up to the possibility that he will contradict me. I was a criminal defense attorney when I was in private practice. So I want to make sure, in fairness to you, if I'm misleading you or giving you a slanted or one-sided presentation, you'll be able to get the last word from somebody else. I'm sure he'll have a lot to teach all of us, including myself. The Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution provides, no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. And this unfortunate amendment has gotten a bad rap in recent times, much of it tragically and unnecessarily through, as you may have heard, the headlines. Let me read you something that was taken out of the newspaper this morning, and I want you to listen to it closely. And I'm giving you a heads up. I'm warning you in advance, which is not fair to you. Not fair to me, but I'm giving you a warning that I'll be quizzing you on this in just a few minutes. This will test your aptitude for legal study and legal practice. Listen closely. It won't take long. Last night, agents of the Norfolk Police Department found three victims of an apparent murder dead in an apartment in the East Ocean View area, the apparent victims of a gangland-style slaying, and possibly the victims of gang-related violence. The police are investigating this as a possible murder and suicide, but right now suspect that the three were all killed by the same individual. No suspects have yet been identified in the slaying, but veteran police detective George Brook has confirmed that police are following up on evidence pointing to the possible involvement of an off-duty naval officer as the perpetrator. The bodies, which were found by the apartment manager at about 8 o'clock in the morning, appear to have been slain sometime earlier in the same evening, probably sometime between midnight and 2 o'clock in the morning. That's it. Those are all the facts I'll ask you to remember, and it won't be for very long either. Let's see how well you do. I'll be quizzing you in just a few minutes. Now, here's the easiest question you'll ever get from a client in all the days of your life. Question, hey, the police are here. They want to talk to me. What should I do? Well, I could give you my answer to that question in case you haven't already guessed it, but why don't we go to a real expert? Justice Robert Jackson, a prosecutor's prosecutor. Like me, he began his private practice in Buffalo, New York, years before I did. And after that, he served as general counsel for the Bureau of Internal Revenue, the U.S. Department of Treasury, the Security and Exchange Commission, assistant U.S. Attorney General for the Tax Division, later the Solicitor General and the Attorney General of the United States, and then the chief U.S. prosecutor for the Nuremberg trials. That's an impressive resume. Years later, when he was a justice on the Supreme Court, Justice Jackson stated, quote, any lawyer worth his salt, today we would say his or her, will tell the suspect, his client, in no uncertain terms to make no statement to the police under any circumstances. There's the title of my talk. I'm here to explain to you the surprising and somewhat counterintuitive and admittedly unlikely reasons why Justice Jackson was right. I'm reminded of this because I'm amazed, we're all amazed, by the frequency with which we see newspaper articles coming out all the time from people who really ought to know better, who say, well, I'll talk to the police. I mean, after all, I'm a senator. I'm O.J. Simpson. I'm an experienced, highly polished individual. I've got a lot of experience with public relations, even criminal defense attorneys. There was a local news story here in the Virginia Pilot just a couple of months ago about an experienced criminal defense lawyer who ended up getting convicted of criminal assault because he talked to the police. He was accused of having assaulted another attorney in the hallway. There were no other witnesses to this. A woman said that he grabbed her by the throat during an argument over a case. He denied it. At trial, it was his word against hers. He said, I did not even touch her. But unfortunately for him, when the police had approached him earlier and said, would you be willing to answer some questions? He said, sure, why not? I'm an attorney. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I'm savvy. I'm sophisticated. I've got oratorical prowess. I'm accustomed to dealing with the police, by all means. And then there was a conversation that was not recorded. When the case went to trial, it was no longer his word against hers, because when he testified at trial, I never touched her. The officer took her to the stand and testified, well, when I met with him, he said he did put his hand on her throat, but just as a joke. Then he had to take the stand again and say, that's not true. I never said that. I never admitted to you that I... Now it's his word against two people. Who's telling the truth? We'll never know for sure. But he was found guilty. Now, here's part of the problem. The heart of the problem, as Justice Breyer on the U.S. Supreme Court explained in 1998, is, quote, the complexity of modern federal criminal law codified in several thousand sections of the United States Code and the virtually infinite variety of factual circumstances that might trigger an investigation into a possible violation of the law make it difficult for anyone to know in advance just when a particular set of statements might later appear to a prosecutor to be relevant to some investigation. One expert on criminal law recently noted that estimates of the current size of the body of federal criminal law vary, although it has been reported that the Congressional Research Service can no longer even count the current number of federal crimes. That's right. Even the federal government has lost count. These laws are scattered over all 50 pages of the U.S. Code, encompassing roughly 27,000 pages. Worse yet, these statutes often incorporate by reference to the provisions of administrative regulations. Estimates of how many such regulations exist are even less well settled, although the ABA thinks there may be nearly 10,000. Here's one of those 10,000 federal criminal statutes on the book that you probably never heard about. It's called the Lacey Act. 16 U.S.C. Section 3370 says it's a federal offense for any person to import, export, transport, sell, receive, acquire, or purchase any fish or wildlife or plant taken, possessed, transported, or sold in the violation of any law, treaty, or regulation of the United States or any Indian tribal law or any state or any foreign law. People have been convicted in federal court for violating this statute because they brought back a bony fish from Honduras, not knowing that Honduran law, not American, but Honduran law, forbade the possession of the bony fish. People have been convicted under this law because they were found in possession of what's called a short lobster, a lobster that's under a certain size. Some states forbid you from possessing a lobster if he's under a certain length. It doesn't matter if he's dead or alive. It doesn't matter if you killed it or if he died of natural causes. It doesn't even matter if you acted in self-defense. Did you know that? Did you know it can be a federal offense to be in possession of a lobster? Admit it. Raise your hand if you did not know that. There's the problem. And that's only one of 10,000 different ways. You know, the government gets pretty upset when people like me instruct the client, people like me and Justice Jackson, don't talk to the police, don't answer any questions. But, you know, they can't have it both ways. You people, you've got 10,000 different ways of convicting us. Good for you. But, you know, with the bitter comes to the sweet, with the good comes to the bad. That's 10,000 different ways my client might unknowingly implicate himself in some sort of a criminal transaction. One of the reasons I decided to give this talk, I recently received a phone call from a former student of mine, a Regent Law School graduate, who may be watching this online. We're putting it on the internet. And he told me, hey, I've been approached by the Internal Revenue Service. They want to ask me a couple of questions. They ask if I'd be willing to. But they say that I'm not a suspect. And I know in my heart I don't think I've done anything wrong in violation of the Internal Revenue Service provisions. Lord have mercy. There's no man on earth, there's no woman in this country who can honestly say with complete confidence, I know I have never violated any provision of the Internal Revenue Code. He said, but they say I'm not a suspect and I know I've done nothing wrong. It's okay if I talk to him. I said, no, you tell them you will not talk to them without immunity. I explained to him why that was true and he never heard from them again. Okay, why you should never talk to the police. Let me just spell it out for you. Let me make it plain to all of you. These are the top 10 reasons. I don't want to actually really lie to you. I don't really have 10. I don't have time for 10, but I've got time for 8 and that'll be close enough. Number one, and this really ought to be good enough, contrary to what you laymen instinctively and naturally suppose, it cannot help. There is no way it can help you. Plenty of folks think that it can, and they're always wrong. You cannot talk your way out of getting arrested. Officer Brooke, you've interviewed thousands of criminal suspects. How many times in your experience have you approached someone, asked if you could ask them some questions because prior to the interview you had some evidence pointing to his possible guilt? And because of the extraordinary persuasiveness and eloquence with which he articulated his innocence, you said, oh, sorry, never mind. Bad call, my bad, I won't, and he talked you out of arresting him.
You know the answer to that.
Never. It never happens. I've often asked other criminal defense attorneys, in all of your experience, have you ever once had a case where you looked back in hindsight and said, thank God my client talked to the police? They laugh at me. They say, you've got to be kidding me. It cannot help you. You can't talk your way out of getting arrested. And contrary to what you might suppose if you never studied the rules of evidence, what you tell the police, even if it's exculpatory, cannot be used to help you at trial. Because it's what we call hearsay. Under the rules of evidence, specifically Rule 801 D2A, if you want to look it up, Everything you tell the police, as the saying goes, can and will be used against you, but it cannot be used for you. From time to time, I've known attorneys who tried to call to the stand a police officer and say, "Officer, would you tell the jury what my client told you, because what my client told him is actually good for my case? If you tried that at trial, the prosecutor will object to that as hearsay, and the judge will agree. The police will not be allowed, at your request, to tell the jury what your client told him, no matter how good it may be for your case. It cannot help. And that ought to be good enough reason. That ought to be reason enough to keep your mouth shut. But if you're not persuaded, let me go talk about a couple of others. Number two, obviously one of the most obvious. If your client is guilty, as many of them are, but even if he's not, even if he's innocent, he may well admit his guilt with no benefit in return. Now, of course, many of you are thinking to yourself, well, what's so wrong about that? I mean, shouldn't guilty people be confessing? Confession's good for the soul. It's good for law enforcement. It's good for the prisons. Yes, yes, sure, all those things are true. And like the rest of you, if I or anyone close to me is ever the victim of some sort of a serious crime, I hope they get the right guy. I hope they convict him. I hope they put him away. We all feel that way. Hey, but what's the rush, friends? You don't got to admit your guilt the first time they come by to meet with you. In federal court, 86% of all defendants plead guilty at some point before trial. If your client is guilty and really ought to punish and really ought to have a go through some sort of a cleansing act of contrition and fess up and admit his guilt, there'll be plenty of time to do that. They almost always do. No need to rush. No need to tell the police something. Wait and see if perhaps your client can work out some sort of an arrangement where maybe he'll make some sort of compensation to the alleged victim, or maybe he'll be able to get some sort of a discount in his sentence. And he'll be treated fairly then, like everybody else who had the benefit of a good lawyer who said, please do not talk to the police. And don't forget, by the way, even if your client only admits things that the police already knew, you might think, well, what harm can it do? He says he wants to talk to the police. All he wants to do is admit that he was there, that the cops know that he was there. All right, go ahead and tell them. Well, how can it hurt? It might hurt if the police officer becomes transferred to Minnesota or deceased or injured or comatose or cannot be located by the time of trial. The case will be dismissed if there's no confession. But if your client admits two things, that confession is freely admissible against him and can be a basis for getting him convicted all by himself. Senator Larry Craig can explain all of this to you. The Innocence Project of the United States has confirmed that in more than 25% of all the cases where an innocent man was convicted and then later released from prison after he was exonerated by DNA evidence, in more than a quarter of those cases, these innocent people, people we know to be innocent, made incriminating statements, delivered outright confessions, or pled guilty. How do they do that? He'll tell us all about it, I trust. Here's a couple of famous examples. You can just ask them. You don't have to take my word for it. There on the left was Eddie Joe Lloyd. He was convicted in 1984 of the murder of a 16-year-old girl in Detroit after he wrote to police with suggestions on how to solve various recent crimes. During several interviews, police fed details of the crime to Mr. Lloyd, who was mentally ill, and they lied to him and convinced this mentally ill man that by confessing, he might help them smoke out the real killer. He later signed a confession. It gave a tape-recorded statement. The jury delivered it less than 1 hour before convicting him on the basis of this confession. There was no other substantial evidence against him. The judge said, "I'd hang you if I could," but the death penalty was not available in Michigan at the time. But after almost 2 decades in prison, he was released after DNA evidence proved that this man was innocent and had falsely confessed to a crime that he did not commit. On the right is Earl Washington, who was released from prison just a few years ago here in Virginia after spending 18 years behind bars after being committed of a rape and a murder that we now know he did not commit after having been exonerated by DNA evidence. But this man, Mr. Washington, who was in fact confirmed to be mentally retarded, was able to confess to several crimes at the request of the police, some of which we know he could not have committed. That's the problem. Some of you are thinking to yourself, well, none of this concerns me because I'm not guilty of anything and I never will be and I will never represent people who do. Okay, let's talk to you people, you innocent folks, those of you who have never committed a crime and never will, and none of your clients will either, and you wouldn't go out with a girl who did. Fine. You better not talk to the police either, okay? Because number three, we'll put the guilty behind us. Forget about them. Let's talk about innocent people. Number three, even if your client is innocent and he denies his guilt and almost entirely tells the truth, odds are good he will easily get carried away and tell some little lie or make some little mistake that will hang him. This is human nature. He gets in there. It's a stressful situation. Imagine a perfectly innocent client. The police say he's been guilty of a murder. He's totally innocent as any one of us. So he goes in there and he meets with the police. He says, "I don't know what you're talking about. I was nowhere near there. I didn't kill him. I've never killed anybody. I don't have a gun. I've never had a gun. I've never touched a gun in my life. I was nowhere near Virginia Beach that night." That last line was a lie. He went over the top. He was getting carried away. He got into this groove. He started saying all kinds of things, almost all of them true, that he knew would tend to exculpate himself. Then he got carried away and just said one thing that wasn't true, and unfortunately for him, they can prove that it wasn't true. He may be convicted on that basis alone. But let's say well, that's not a problem. I'll tell my client only to tell the truth. I've met with him. I know he won't lie to the police. He won't make any mistakes. Okay, that's still no guarantee you won't be getting into trouble. Because even if your client is innocent and only tells the truth and doesn't say anything that is false. Now, already, mind you, we're pretty well nigh into fantasy land. The odds of this being anybody being able to pull this off are really quite slim, no matter how innocent they may be. But just for the same, let's pretend. Let's assume he gives the police nothing but the truth, and he is totally innocent. He will always give the police some information that can be used to help convict him. Always. For example, suppose you tell this to the police. Here's what your client tells to the police in his denial of guilt. I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't kill Jones. I don't know who did. I wasn't anywhere near that place. I don't have a gun. I've never owned a gun in my life. I don't even know how to use a gun. Yeah, sure, I never liked the guy, but who did? I wouldn't kill him. I've never hurt anybody in my life, and I would never do such a thing. Let's suppose every word of that is true, 100% of it is true. What will the jury hear at trial? Officer Brooke, was there anything about this, your interrogation, your interview with the suspect that made you concerned that he might be the right one? Yes, there was. He confessed to me that he never liked the guy. And then the prosecutor will put that up in big letters, and he'll say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, it's pretty clear that we've got the right guy here. We've proven that he was in Virginia Beach that night. That's opportunity. And remember, Officer Brooke admitted that after extended questioning, he was finally able to get the defendant to admit that he never liked the guy. There's your motive. Motive plus opportunity. Wham, bam. Please. But juries eat it up. And innocent people get convicted this way sometimes. How often? Hopefully not too often, but we know what happens. The United States Supreme Court, don't take my word for this, in Ohio versus Reiner, the Supreme Court of the United States said, quote, one of the Fifth Amendment's basic functions is to protect innocent men who otherwise might be ensnared by ambiguous circumstances. Truthful responses of an innocent witness, as well as those of a wrongdoer, may provide the government with incriminating evidence from the speaker's own mouth. See, it's not just some criminal defense attorney telling you this. Even the Supreme Court says I'm right. Under the facts of that case, by the way, in Ohio versus Reiner, a child tragically was died, apparently the result of shaken baby syndrome. Question was who had shaken this baby to death. And one of the possible suspects was a babysitter who had spent some time with the child that week. The babysitter's story was, I don't know what you're talking about. I did not kill the child. I did not see it happen. I don't know who shook the baby. It was never me. I never did anything of any violent nature to the child. The Ohio State Court said, well, you've got no Fifth Amendment privilege. You, by your own admission, told the investigators that you've done nothing wrong, that you were not involved. So obviously your answers can't incriminate you. The United States Supreme Court reversed and said, well, that's not true. Even though this babysitter denies shaking the child, denies seeing the child die, denies knowing how the child died, this babysitter, by her own admission, apparently the government wanted to ask whether the babysitter might have been with the child at some point that week, during the week prior to the death. And that answer, although by itself not sufficient to convict anybody, could help convict her. That means she's got a Fifth Amendment right to refuse to answer to the question the court held, because it could be used to help convict. Allman versus United States, which the Supreme Court said more than 50 years ago, eerily prophetic. They said too many Americans, even those who should be better advised, view this privilege as a shelter for wrongdoers. They too readily assume that those who invoke it are either guilty of crime or commit perjury in claiming the privilege. That's not true, and it never has been. But it gets worse. Can it get worse? It can. Number five, even if your client is innocent and only tells her the truth and does not tell the police anything incriminating, which, by the way, is almost impossible to pull this off. I mean, imagine talking to the police for 2, 3, 4 hours, and somebody like him can't somehow manage to extract from you something that could be used to help convict you. That'd be extraordinary. I don't think anybody's pulled it off. But even if you could pull it off, there's still a grave chance that his answers can and will be used to crucify you in a court of law if the police, no offense, don't recall his testimony with 100% accuracy. All right, now this brings us back to that pop quiz I warned you about. I told you earlier, remember, it's only been a few minutes, and you weren't up all night, and you weren't the subject of physical duress. You were in the relaxed setting of a classroom here. You were given heads up, advance notice that you would be quizzed on this. Question. We'll start with a couple of easy ones. Remember that article I read you about that? How many people did the police find shot to death last night at that Ocean View apartment that I told you about? A, 1, B, 2, C, 3, D, 4. Who says A? B. C. Get this. Get that with a camera. Move that camera around. Look how many hands we've got there for C. Okay, D. You're all wrong. Everybody who raised their hand, you are the kind of people who should never talk to the police under any circumstances for as long as you live. Why is C not the right answer, by the way? If you know, raise your hand. Yes. Excellent. I didn't say anybody was shot. I didn't say gun, bullet, shooting, firearms. Didn't use any of those words. But I don't blame you if you thought that I did. This is the way the human mind works. We hear things. We fill in details. I said gangland-style slang. That may or may not imply something, but it doesn't mean that anybody was shot. And that's the problem. You see, even if your client is innocent and only tells the truth and doesn't tell them anything incriminating and his statement is videotaped, his answers can be used to crucify him. You might say, wait, how can that happen? I insisted. In my insistence, I called the police and I said, look, if you want to talk to my client, you can talk to him, but only if you videotape the whole thing. I don't want there to be any debate between the two of you over what happened. Okay, we'll videotape the whole thing. If the police don't recall their questions with 100% accuracy, he'll be convicted on that statement alone. For example, suppose a man goes to the police. They say, we're investigating a possible murder, a shooting. And the guy says, quote, I don't know who killed Jones, Officer Brooke, with all due respect. It wasn't me. I've never touched or fired a gun in my life. How can that help incriminate this man? How could that possibly be used against this man to help convict him? You would think it's inconceivable. But it's as easy as pie. All the officer has to do is read the statement to the jury, and then the prosecutor says, Officer Brooke, was there anything about that statement that confused you or surprised you? Yes, there was, he says in a moment of sinister high drama in the courtroom. And what was that? And then Officer Brooke turns to the jurors and he says, I never said anything about a shooting. I said we were investigating a murder. He was the one who brought up a gun. Then you turn to your client, and your client says, That's not true. I remember he was the one, or one of the cops. I was with them for 3 hours. One of them in the car said something about, they said they had a witness that I was the shooter. Okay, I'll put you on the stand. And then your client testifies, No, they did tell me shooting. They mentioned it before I said anything about a gun. They brought it up first. And then the police said, that's not true. And now what? It's your word against theirs? For what? You're gambling with your client's life. And police officers can very easily make a mistake like that, just as so many of you did just a few minutes ago, about whether you recalled having heard me say something about somebody actually being shot. Police make mistakes, innocently, inadvertently, unintentionally. Any statement, no matter how exculpatory it may seem on its face, can be used to crucify you all by itself if the police are either willing to lie, not likely, or if they just have an innocent misrecollection of the details as to what they did and did not tell you before you told them what you said. All of these, by the way, all of these problems disappear if you take Justice Jackson's advice and say, thank you very much, officer, but no thanks. How about this one? Here we go. Now, here's the most surprising of all. I've saved the most surprising one for a last. Let's suppose you've got the following scenario. Your client's thinking about talking to the police. He says, I've got nothing to hide. They think that I killed somebody in Virginia Beach last night. Well, this is what your client tells you in confidence. I don't know who robbed that store. It wasn't me. In fact, I've got a pretty good alibi. I wasn't even in Virginia Beach that night, last night. I was 4 hours away visiting my mother in the Outer Banks. Unfortunately, no, I did not pay for gas with a credit card. I used cash, and so I've got no witnesses that can prove I was there except my word, and of course, Mama, for what that's worth, which is nothing. So your client says, so the police want to talk to me, and I want to seem cooperative, so what I'll do is I'll tell them that I was in the Outer Banks last night. Now, there's nothing on its face incriminating about any of that. Let's assume, by the way, that you believe with all your doubt, you've given your client a polygraph exam. You've known him for years. You've been going to the same Bible study for 30 years. You know beyond a shadow of a doubt that he's telling you the truth. And he's not admitting anything. He's not admitting motive. He's not admitting opportunity. He's not admitting that he was there. How on earth could this come back to haunt us? How on earth could this come back to be used against us? Be honest. Raise your hand if you really think the answer to that question is, I can't see how it could possibly be used against me. You're afraid I'll call on you, right? I won't call on you. Well, you're wrong. You're dead wrong. You're always wrong. Everything you say, every time you talk to the police, you will regret it. You see, the problem is, here it is. This is the last point. I think it's almost, even if your client is innocent and only tells the truth and doesn't tell the police anything incriminating and the entire interview, questions and answers are videotaped, even his truthful answers can be helped to use crucify even an innocent man if the police, through no fault of theirs, end up in the possession of any evidence, even mistaken and unreliable evidence, that anything your client told them was false, even if in fact it was true. Again, going back to this example from a moment ago. Let's suppose I go ahead and I meet with the police. I think I got nothing to hide. I tell them I was in the Outer Banks last night, officer. How can that be used to convict me? By itself, it cannot. It cannot help at all by itself. But what if I later find out, to my horror, after I put my cards on the table, that they've got a witness, a girl that I went to high school with, an unimpeachable witness. We've never been enemies. She'd have no reason to lie. She swears she thinks she saw me in Virginia Beach last night, a couple of blocks away from that store, about an hour before it was robbed. Now, her testimony by itself isn't going to help the prosecutor. Hell, if she's all they've got, I'll get this case thrown out before trial. But if, like an idiot, I talked to the police and I told them the truth, I told them I was in the Outer Banks, and now, lo and behold, tragically, it turns out they've got a witness, a false, mistaken, confused, but sincere, incredible witness, who could testify that I was here at Virginia Beach, now they're likely to get a conviction. Because what they'll do, I've just turned this cop and this woman into the government star witnesses. They'll put Officer Brooke on to testify about how my client lied to him about being in the Outer Banks. And then They'll put on this girl, this is a girl who otherwise would have not even helped their case at all, who will testify, no, that's not true, that was a lie. I saw Mr. Duane's client here in Virginia an hour before the robbery, not so far from the store. By herself, she would not have helped the government in any significant way. But what I have just done, you see, is given them the other part of the puzzle. And now I'm doomed. Just ask them. I close with this example. Here we have a couple of recent celebrity examples of why it is that even people who admit nothing always end up denying it. They always end up regretting it. On the left, we have Martha Stewart. She was the subject of an extensive government investigation that was looking into the possibility that she was guilty of violations of certain federal laws, securities laws, fraud kinds of things. They couldn't pin that on her, but they were able to get a conviction because she denied it. Talking to the police and later to some of the shareholders, she said, no, it's not true. I was not guilty. So they charged her with lying to federal investigators, and they got a conviction, and she was sentenced to 5 months in prison. Marion Jones, on the right side, another person who would still be out today if she had always taken the advice that I'm giving you now. She was asked if she had ever used steroids, a controlled substance. And instead of taking the fifth, she said, no, I never took steroids when I won those Olympic gold medals. Later on, it turned out that she was lying. She worked out a deal. She pled guilty. She admitted that she was lying. And she, over her strenuous, tear-filled objection, even though she has two young children, was just recently sentenced to prison for 6 months. The guy who sold her the steroids, the pusher, he got only 4 months. But she got 6 months because she lied to the police and said that she did not do it. You see the problem. Michael Vick, who originally pled guilty, as you know, to these charges with respect to the operation of this dog combat sort of operation at his home. At sentencing, like many other criminal defendants, even though he eventually pled guilty, at sentencing, one of the reasons his sentence was a little harder than it might have otherwise been, the judge said, was because when he initially met with the police, he lied to them and said, I didn't do anything. I didn't do it. I don't know what you're talking about. Even guilty people, but not only guilty people, will always end up regretting talking to the police. So my advice to you, Justice Jackson was right. Any sane, competent lawyer in his right mind will always tell every client under all circumstances, I don't care if you're innocent. I don't care if it's the truth. If it's the truth, great. We'll tell the jury all about it. There'll be time enough to put our cards on the table. But before we get there, I haven't seen yet what the police got. They may have mistaken and confused witnesses who will contradict even the truthful stuff that you say. We have no way to know, no way to predict whether the information that you give them, even if truthful and reliable, will end up unwittingly dispelling our demise. So keep your mouth shut. Don't answer any questions. Let's take the fifth. You'll be glad that you did. God bless.
And that's almost all we have time for. Regarding what I do with police often, it really varies from moment to moment. I rarely have faced any serious charges. That happened on one occasion when I was accused of felony conspiracy for being inside a building as a reporter with the Occupy movement at the 75 River Street, along with the Santa Cruz 11, who were also accused of that, some who were, some who weren't. Because I'm a reporter and I do a lot of talking on the air, I actually reported from inside the building. but in any case, my response to police is to ask questions rather than to answer them. Unless I see some real reason for assisting them in some other way because of something else that's happening, I don't have a lot of confidence in what they do. I see them often in a discriminatory fashion treating homeless people. I also, a lot of the things that this law professor attorney is telling you from a lawyer's point of view are fine if you have the resources to hire an attorney and deal with all this kind of stuff in court and save it for trial. Many people, and the reason homeless people succumb to violations of their rights when the police tell them to do something that they should have no right to force them to do is because they're alone, they're afraid, it's late at night, the police officer is armed, and it isn't all, this professor is being very gentle with the police. Say, oh, they almost never lie. Well, Baker lied repeatedly, for instance, at least on a number of occasions that I was aware of. In any case, when that happens, you're screwed if you are, placing any confidence in that. But the reason that homeless people don't actually, often people are outside and vulnerable, they have to make their own kind of arrangement with the police. Unless they have support from each other, unless they have contact with the media, video support, unless they have civil rights support from civil rights groups. I've spent a lot of time trying to encourage that to happen. Not terribly successful at it, but we'll continue to try to do it. And that's about it for this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. If you want to hear more of Don't Talk to the Police, go online to YouTube, look at the video, Don't Talk to the Police. It's got some visual aids as well that are interesting. I have a kind of a fascination with the law, even though I hold much of the law in great contempt, because it's made, I think, for the wealthy and the privileged, and it's used by the police to support the status quo, which is simply bad. I'll be back on Sunday with the usual 9:30 show, and perhaps I'll talk to you again then. It's looking increasingly like I'm running on flashbacks, and that may be happening too, but I'll try to throw in some topical stuff if it comes my way or if I come its way. And thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Give me a call if you'd like at 423-4833 if you want more information about how to get on free radio, reports on what's going on the streets, or stuff like that.
Yes, yes, this is Low Key, straight from London, and you're listening to Freak Radio. Keep it locked.
ribbon, L.A. lady.